A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rehm, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on February 19, 1995, entitled Epiphany Eyes. The scripture readings are Psalm 27, verses 1 through 8, Ephesians 1, verses 15 through 23, and John 1, verses 1 through 5. The text for the sermon is Ephesians 1, verses 17 through 19. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
It's good to be back with you, and it's great to come back on a Sunday in which we have with us the boys from the choir, the boys and men's choir from Grand Rapids. Glad that some of the boys could be here. They'll be joined by others, plus the men at the 4 o'clock concert. When Nancy and I were in England for a month in 89, we didn't always make high tea, but we always stopped at a cathedral along the way at about 5 o'clock for evensong. And a couple of times we might have been the only ones there, but it was glorious, the space and the sound. And I know that this afternoon's concert will bring back memories of those great worship experiences in the cathedrals in England. Well, as I was saying, that is three Sundays ago, as we concluded a series of overviewing the New Testament story, the story of the Jesus movement, we noted that the story goes on. And we noted that the book of Luke, or the book of Acts, authored by Luke, comes to an end, but obviously without an ending. And that there would seem to be every intention that the narrative would be picked up at some point. And although the narrative was never picked up within the canon of the scripture, the story has gone on and the story has been written. And it is the ongoing story of the community of faith that issued from the event of Jesus Christ. The Apostle Paul was in Rome, a prisoner of the empire. There he was, preaching, teaching, persuading all who would come to him in his experience of house arrest, that God, as a matter of fact, the eternal God, the creator of all that is, had spoken definitively in Jesus Christ, the Word made flesh, this one, this human one, in whom was embodied the light of the knowledge of the glory of God. And Paul was so convinced that the eternal God, the God of Israel, had spoken in this one, that he traversed the ancient world, persuading, preaching, cajoling, with great passion and great intensity, because he believed that God had an eternal purpose. As he says in this letter to the Ephesians in the opening verses, a purpose before the foundations of the world. In other words, in the depths of the being of God from all eternity, a gracious intention for creation to gather all things together in a unity. And it was Paul's conviction that in this one Jesus, there was the embodiment, the tangible presence of this eternal one out of the depths of eternity, moving in and touching, invading, as it were, our reality so that we could actually behold him and see in his face into the heart of the Creator of the heavens and the earth. Paul was one of the great thinkers of all Christian reality. In a recent book by Hans Küng entitled Great Thinkers, he picks seven thinkers out who through the past 2,000 years have been responsible for significant shifts in understanding of the faith, in understanding of the world and of God and of history and of the purposes of God, and gives a little thumbnail sketch of these individuals. And all of them were familiar to me, of course, but I was interested in the fact that the first paradigmatic thinker, the first Christian thinker who effected a significant paradigm shift in the understanding of the faith, according to Hans Küng, was the Apostle Paul. And I have to believe that he's right about that. Paul has gotten rather bad press in our day, even in the recent theological development of the last century or two. There have been those who have said that Paul missed the boat. Nietzsche said there's only ever been one Christian in the world, and he died on the cross. And in his book Antichrist, he derided Paul for falsifying the gospel of Jesus. Well, in theological development, we've seen some attempt to go behind Paul, to get back to Jesus. But as a matter of fact, I love the perspective in which Hans Küng places St. Paul. For he places him as a significant, brilliant, powerful, passionate thinker who was able to shift the whole understanding of the church as to the purposes of God as it affects the world. He was the one, if you go back to the 15th chapter of Acts, the story that we have surveyed so recently, Paul was the one who at that council in Jerusalem, called by the apostles, was able to move the Christian movement, or the Jesus movement, from a Jewish Christian reality to a reality that embraced Jew and Gentile alike, but without making the Gentile first become a Jew. Paul said it was grace and grace alone. And it was out of his own life-shattering, life-transforming experience that he got this breakthrough, this new insight. Suddenly, the faith of Israel and the God of Israel, from which he never turned away, became so much brighter and so much grander. And he recognized an eternal purpose of God for which the experience of Israel was preparatory, leading to the movement in Jesus, moving to the embrace of the whole world. It was that universal grace of God to embrace all humankind out of his own experience that propelled Paul, that compelled Paul with this passionate intensity to go all over the world, wherever he could go, trying to convince and to persuade that in Jesus something significant, of eternal significance, had occurred. So Paul, not really a stodgy, old, rigid theologian, Paul was brilliant. Paul was bold. Paul dared to move into new territory, to blaze new trails. He was a pioneer thinker. And one of the letters that is generally attributed to him, although perhaps not for sure, nonetheless, in a letter that certainly sounds like it's got a lot of Paul in it, the letter to the Ephesians, we have in the morning lesson a marvelous prayer of Paul for this congregation. And it is a prayer that they'll receive the gift of epiphany eyes. I can just imagine Paul wanting so intently to have people see, and to have them see not simply as a physical act, not simply to have sight, but to have insight. And so after that moving first paragraph in which he speaks about the eternal purposes of God in grace, he says, I bow my knees and I pray. And I pray that God will give to you a spirit of wisdom and revelation in order that the eyes of your heart be illumined. Isn't that an interesting phrase? The eyes of your heart, that you might see from the depths of your being, that you might not only have sight, but that you might have insight, that you might not only see, but that you might see through, that you might break through, that you might come to some new and grand and wonderful and magnificent deeper knowledge and understanding than you've ever had before, that your experience be not static, but that it be alive and dynamic and growing because the news is so spectacular. I pray, he says, this preacher and apostle who would just, I'm sure, love to have taken everyone by the lapels and shaken them and said, don't you see? Don't you see? I want you to see this. I pray that God will give you a spirit of wisdom and revelation, that the eyes of your heart be illumined, that you might come to know the hope to which you are called and the inheritance that is yours as the children of God and the power that is available to you, the power with which God literally conquered death, raising Jesus from the dead. This passionate apostle prayed because he knew that what he was about was beyond his capacity to effect. He knew that the vision that he had gotten was that could be shared only as the Spirit of God gave epiphany eyes. Epiphany. That Greek word that we throw around here, the word that names this season, which in our worship we draw to a conclusion today. Epiphany, appearance or manifestation. This Jesus who appeared, in whom the eternal God was manifest. Paul says, I pray God to give you epiphany eyes. Eyes that see what was always there, but see suddenly, through the gift of the Spirit, something that takes on luminous, revelatory brilliance. So that suddenly, in a moment, has it happened to you? Do you know the experience where all at once you say, I see. I see. Oh, I see. That's what Paul was praying about. That's what he was hoping for. That's what he was longing for with those to whom he had brought the good news of God in Jesus Christ. That they would have eyes to see, that would see through, that would see the grandeur and the magnificence of that vision that he caught through his own life-transforming encounter with Jesus Christ when he came to a vision of the grace of God such as he had never experienced before. And I would pray the same for all of us, that there might be a growing knowledge, but not in the sense of raw data, but in the sense of deepening experience and expansive vision of the wonders of God and God's grace and the whole cosmic development of which we are a part. And I bring that to you this morning because I think it's so important that we catch the sense of revelation that Paul is speaking of here. One of the great barriers to new thoughts and one of the great hindrances to making any progress in our sorting out of the world and dealing with the problems, the new situations and circumstances that continue to arise. One of the great hindrances, burdens that we deal with in the church is that we have such a static view of revelation, as though revelation somehow or other was an event in the past or a series of events in the past, and that it was encapsulated and captured and put in between the covers of a book, and now we need to go back to this book in order that we might be in touch with the revelation that happened but is a past phenomenon. But you see, Paul would never tolerate that which has developed over 2,000 years in the church. Paul was praying that there might be that continuing, dynamic, creative encounter between people and the Spirit of God in order that their vision, that their sight, that their insight, that their experience and their knowledge would be alive, and that they would never have closure on all of this, but that they might stay open-hearted and open-minded to what things God was yet revealing and showing to those who were moving through the course of history, the course of history that is accompanied by the Spirit of God in the cosmos that is permeated with the presence and the power of God. Ah, Paul had an idea, had a conception of the God who speaks, the God who continues to speak and to direct and to guide and to give vision and to give insight. And I believe that as we come to the close of a century and a millennium, that it is perhaps the threshold of new breakthroughs such as we've not yet dreamed of in our understanding of God and humankind and history and the meaning of it all. And perhaps the new revealing will take place not apart from the Scripture, but in the contemplation of the book of nature. Coming off from vacation, I had opportunity to do some reading again, so of course you're in trouble. But one of the areas that has been fascinated me, has always fascinated me, but it fascinates me even more today, is the relationship between theological understanding, faith understanding, and the understanding of the cosmic reality that comes to us through the physical sciences, through physics and astronomy. And as I delve a little bit into that area, which is far beyond my abilities and capacity, but nonetheless, which teases me a bit, I see that we are in a period of time when at the leading edge of scientific investigation, there is the possibility for new and creative theological formulations such as perhaps has never been the case before. The Apostle Paul speaks about the grace of God that was in the intention, the heart of God, from before the foundations of the world. But Paul obviously had no conception of the physical universe such as we have. And in our own day, in our own century, because of the possibility of instrumentation and all of that that has come to light to facilitate the probing of the secrets of the universe, we have a knowledge and an understanding which is in only its beginning stages, full yet of mystery, but which explodes the kind of mechanical conception of things that held sway for a long, long time. The kind of physics that came from Sir Isaac Newton with his universe of cause and effect, the kind of mechanical physics of the 18th and 19th centuries. Within the 20th century, there have been three significant paradigmatic shifts in the understanding of the physical universe. The name of Einstein is familiar to us all, even though we don't understand the theory of relativity. But the implications of that are tremendous. And then to Einstein's despair and unhappiness, physical understanding and theory moved beyond him to quantum theory or quantum mechanics, which spoke about the building blocks of the universe as being unpredictable and open, so that the whole universe is open to creativity and spontaneity like Einstein despaired of. Einstein never would believe it. He never would quite accept it, but the data is overwhelming. He finally died, still muttering about the fact that the old man doesn't play dice. But quantum theory is holding sway. And the most recent idea to be floated is called chaos theory. And chaos theory speaks about cosmic reality, atoms and things that are the building blocks of all that is, us included, who are made of star stuff. Chaos theory says that there are larger patterns out there than we've yet conceived of. For example, when a wave breaks on the shore, it can be beautiful, but it looks like chaos. But with the possibilities that computers give us, the actual breaking of that wave can be calculated. And last night, did you see the sunset? Did you see those puffy little clouds that skittered across the sky like lamb's wool as they caught the setting sun's gold? And I looked at the sky with that magnificent beauty and that amazing disorderliness that had its own order, and realized that that's what the cosmologists, the physicists, the astronomers are talking about when they talk about chaos theory, which may defy our ability to put it into some kind of a package, but to see it nonetheless as a movement of something greater and grander. And with all of those things which I barely understand enough even to dare to speak of in this place, what picture I get is of a God who is infinite. I don't think we have begun to contemplate what we confess when we speak of God as infinite. For it is our human tendency to turn down, to bring closure, to try to get our hands around, to be able to manage. When, as a matter of fact, the most sophisticated of science in our world today is being dumbstruck by the awesomeness of the mystery that is beyond any conceivability. And so, when I read of that, and then I come across a wonderful study by an Anglican woman in a book entitled Soul, who says, what kind of a God fits with chaos theory? I am deeply moved. For, quoting some of the finest thinkers and minds of our day, she points out that this universe of ours is not at the end of its rope. It took 10 billion years, friends, for the cosmic soup to simmer in order to bring about and evolve the very possibility of life. And then millions of years for that evolvement of life to come to the possibility of consciousness, to come to the relative recent development of creatures like ourselves that can reflect back on ourselves and self-consciously reflect on a creator God. And there are those now who are saying that it took as long as it has taken, with all of the finely tuned balances that have transpired, in order for human life as we know it to be a possibility. And the universe is young, and humankind is hardly in its adolescence. And who knows what God has yet in mind and in eternal depths for this ongoing cosmic drama into which our lives are woven. One of the things that seems clear to me is that the traditional conception of fallenness that has thrown a pall over all of reality and all of human endeavor needs to be exchanged for an idea of development, which comes out of a sense of the cosmic reality that is there before us today. You cannot have seismic shifts in the understanding of the cosmos without it impacting our faith understanding. And the marvelous thing is that what these recent insights and breakthroughs have given us is the picture of a God of creativity and of a world of spontaneity and of a human person caught up in the web of things, participating actively in that drama that is evolving. And if our lives and our history seem to be dogged by chaos and by darkness, and certainly in our human experience there is enough of that, then might not what we understand in the chaotic breaking of a wave also be true in our limited human experience? That which seems so senseless and so wrong, of which we can make no sense whatsoever, is yet part of something bigger and grander that we cannot yet grasp. But that because we believe in God, because we believe from the depths of eternity, God had intention and purpose, an intention and purpose of love and grace, can we not then capture what Paul was stammering to express? Can we not also open our minds and hearts to the possibility that there may be some breakthrough and understanding and insight that lies before us, because God is God, and that given the gift of epiphany eyes, we may be able to see what has always been there but never truly seen, and that just maybe there is a hope built into the very structure of reality that we can claim as our hope, and that the magnificence of the infinite God will have an inheritance for us of which we've not yet dreamed, and that this cosmos, which is energy, sizzling with energy, alive with energy, that this cosmos, which is energized by the breath of God, has available also for us a power that we've not yet appropriated. You see, we want to get our heads and our arms around it all. We want to draw it in. We want to be able to calculate it and manage it. To say 1, 2, 3, ABC. And what we are learning from the book of nature is that it is far beyond our feeble conception. It is greater, more wonderful, magnificent. But at its core, there's a ground of hope, and there is a future, and in the present there is a power. I can identify with Paul. He would say, don't you see it? Don't you see it? Don't you sense it? Don't you know we've only scratched the surface of it? The wonder of it all. I mean, don't you see it, people? Can't you feel it? Don't you know that the best is yet to be?